Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Vic and Bab Kenyon is going to talk for us on Armenia, Australia and the Great War, around the occasion of the launch of his book, which is co-written with the well-known Australian historian Peter Stanley, Armenia, Australia and the Great War, published by New South or UNSW Press. I'll introduce our speaker briefly. Vic and Bab Kenyon is an independent researcher for the Australian Institute of Holocaust and Genocide Studies in Sydney. He has written several articles in Australian International Humanitarianism for peer-reviewed history journals. His research has been cited in radio and television documentaries on the First World War and its aftermath. So welcome to our speaker on this important topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, on the evening of 24 April 1915, just hours before the Anzac landing at Gallipoli, the Ottoman authorities arrested about 230 Armenian political, religious, educational and intellectual leaders in Constantinople, which is now Istanbul, the capital of the Ottoman Empire back then. They were taken to police headquarters and deported into the interior of Turkey. Most were killed without a trace. This marked the beginning of what Henry Morgenthau, the United States ambassador to the Ottoman Empire in 1915, described as a campaign of race extermination. In almost every town and village in Turkey, the Armenian population was arrested and deported by orders from the central government in Constantinople, under the direction of the Minister of Interior, Talat Pasha. In most cases, the men were just killed outside their towns and villages. A much worse fate awaited the women and children. After being uprooted from their homes, they were forced to walk southwards in huge convoys towards the burning deserts of what is now northern Syria. Most would die of starvation, disease, murder, and many were abducted. And the map that I've got here is just illustrates how the deportations were carried out and the areas of massacres. And that's a pretty much current-day Turkey encompasses most of that map today. And you'll notice that Gallipoli is up there on the left. But as you can see from the deportation routes, they were not just in the theatres of war. The deportations were carried out all throughout the empire, even in areas that were far, far from the war zones. For the Armenians, 24 April 1915 signifies the beginning of the Ottoman Empire's campaign to exterminate its Christian Armenian population. For many Australians, the 25th of April signifies the beginning of a military campaign that would help forge Australia's national identity. These two events have more in common than just a coincidence of dates and geography. They are also linked together by a humanitarian bond, which began in 1915 and lasted for more than a decade. So my presentation today will explore the largely forgotten story of Australia's response to the Armenian genocide. Armenians are an ancient people who have inhabited the highlands of today's eastern Turkey and the Caucasus for thousands of years. Armenia became arguably the world's first nation to adopt Christianity in the first decades of the 4th century. And throughout its long history, Armenia has been repeatedly invaded by regional powers. And by the 15th century, most of Armenia was absorbed by the Ottoman Empire. And the Armenians over those centuries developed a unique form of Christian art. And I've just got some examples there on the PowerPoint. There's some cross stones, which is a very unique form of Armenian art. I think the Irish have something similar too. And Armenian church, there's an example of an Armenian church there on the left from the, I think, 11th century. While the Ottoman Islamic political system required the protection and toleration of people of the book, meaning Jews and Christians. Non-Muslims face discrimination, including extra taxes, judicial inequality, and a prohibition on bearing arms. In the late 19th century, Armenian demands for reform were met with repression by the Ottoman authorities. Tens of thousands of Armenians were massacred between the years 1894 and 1896. By the early 20th century, while most of the 2 million Armenians in the Ottoman Empire lived in their historic homelands in today's eastern Turkey, Armenian communities existed all over the Ottoman Empire, including the Gallipoli Peninsula. And so I've got a photo there of the Army, although it was taken in 1925, but there was an Armenian quarter at Gallipoli, which had about 2,000 Armenians living there just prior to World War I. And the Gallipoli Armenians, who numbered 2,000, had a neighbourhood named after them, which contained a St. George Church and two Armenian schools. They were mainly occupied in trading, fishing and crafts. 2 weeks before the Anzac landings, the Ottoman authorities deported the Gallipoli Armenians, along with about 20,000 of the peninsula's native Greek population, into the interior of Anatolia. Many would die of harsh conditions. When I say Anatolia, we mean what is today Western Turkey. Australian encounters with Armenians proliferated with the Anzac landing at Gallipoli on 25 April 1915. Like the British and French forces, Imperial forces, the Ottoman army reflected the multi-ethnic makeup of the Ottoman Empire. Despite being commonly referred to as Turks, members of the Ottoman army included Turks, Arabs, Kurds, Armenians, Greeks, Assyrians, Circassians, and more. On the first day of the landing, the Anzacs had captured at least one Ottoman Armenian. As the campaign continued, the number of Armenian prisoners increased. Since many of them were multilingual and considered to be quite pro-allied, Armenian prisoners were recruited as interpreters. And by May 1915, there was a colony of Armenian interpreters serving at the Anzac headquarters. A large portion of the army's medical personnel, of the Ottoman army's medical personnel, such as doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and sanitary workers, were Armenians. Many Anzacs captured as prisoners make specific mention in their memoirs how Armenian doctors in the Red Crescent, which was the Ottoman equivalent to the Red Cross, treated the Anzac prisoners kindly. The Anzacs at Gallipoli also came to learn that there was a distinct hierarchy among the different ethnicities in the Ottoman army. Armenians and Greeks were generally recruited into labour battalions, which were held in low esteem. In a letter to his nephew in November 1915, Lieutenant Edward Gaynor wrote from Gallipoli that the Turkish soldier does no work, but the Armenians and other Christians are herded together into battalions to do nothing else but dig trenches. Gaynor thought it would have been a boon and a blessing if he had such working battalions, as his fighting men spent half their time digging trenches. By October 1915, the plight of the Armenians was common knowledge worldwide. In the introduction of a lengthy article on the Armenian persecutions in December 1915, the Australian war correspondent at Gallipoli, Charles Bean, wrote, "The Turks, as the world knows, are at the present moment engaged in an endeavour to wipe out the Armenian nation before they are stopped." At least 200 Australians were captured by the Ottoman or taken prisoners by the Ottoman army during World War I. They included those captured at Gallipoli, the Sinai, Mesopotamia, and the submariners who penetrated the Dardanelles in 1915. The Australians were most often held in abandoned Armenian churches and homes. They observed and recorded the deportations and massacres occurring around them. Lieutenant Leslie Luscombe from Geelong West had been part of the 14th Battalion, Australian Infantry Battalion, at Gallipoli when he was captured and taken prisoner in August 1915. While being transported to the centuries-old Holy Mother of God Armenian Monastery in Ankara, he witnessed a sad and depressing sight at the railway station in Western Turkey Luscombe wrote, "On the opposite side of the platform, a considerable number of Armenian women and children were huddled together. As our train pulled into the platform, Turkish soldiers armed with whips were driving the women and children into the train. It was evidently intended to transport them to some distant concentration camp." Luscombe learned that just before his arrival at the Armenian monastery, the monks of the monastery had been taken out and massacred by the Turks. Now, I've got a photo of Lieutenant Luscombe. He's at the top left in that one there. That photo was taken in November, December 1918. And that's a photo that was just found recently of the Armenian monastery in Ankara. It was built in the 14th century, but it no longer exists. And we've tried to get in contact with historical societies in Ankara to locate where it exactly was. And I don't even know where it was, because the city of Ankara has been built, so heavily built. But it's part of the cultural destruction as well, of Armenian cultural heritage. The Armenian Quarter and the Holy Mother of God Armenian Church at Afyon Karahisar in western Turkey became the major internment camp for Allied prisoners of war during World War I. And upon arriving at the church, Australian prisoner Captain Thomas White of the Australian Flying Corps saw a number of Armenian women and children of all ages sitting outside the church on bundles of clothing. Evidently, he wrote, they had been moved out to make way for us. White was not surprised to see them looking very sad and miserable, for he wrote, their menfolk had been killed, their houses and furniture confiscated, and now they were being turned out into the street from their last possible sanctuary. So the Armenian Church of Afyon Karahisar, I've got a photo there from, which is dated during World War I, and I'll just show you where it is. It's this building here. And that other photo is a recent photo taken today of what remains of that Armenian church in Afyon Karahisar, which became the main internment camp for Allied prisoners of war during World War I. And that's a photo of Captain Thomas White, one of the most famous Australian prisoners of war, who later became a cabinet minister for the Menzies government and Australia's High Commissioner to Britain. And the Armenian Quarter of Afyon Karahisar was also used to house officers, Allied officers, and one of their houses was called Australia House, where the Australian House officers lived, and it's sort of in the middle on the left there. In July 1915, about 5,000 inhabitants of six Armenian villages near the Mediterranean Sea in southeastern Turkey, in a place called Musadav, which means Mount Moses, decided to resist the Turks rather than be deported. And after 53 days of resistance, they were miraculously saved by a French warship patrolling the Mediterranean Sea. And at the time, it was quite heavily publicized throughout the world. That's an article from Australia. And the other one's from the Graphic in London. And these 5,000 Armenian refugees were taken to Port Said, Egypt, where the senior British officer at the Suez Canal made use of three Australian supply ships to meet the emergency. This included blankets, tents, and food. The proximity of the refugee camp to the Anzacs stationed in Egypt meant that there were frequent encounters between Australian military personnel and the Armenian refugees. Many Anzacs would purchase Armenian handiwork and send them back as gifts to their families in Australia. So I found quite a number of accounts of Australians writing letters back home and sending gifts of handiwork made by the Armenian refugees in Egypt. And there's some more photographs of the Armenian refugee camps. And as the Anzac forces advanced on the Palestine-Syria front in 1918, they encountered many deported Armenians. Lieutenant Colonel Arthur James Mills was among a contingent of Australian light horsemen and cameliers on the Palestine front who helped rescue several thousand Armenian refugees in early 1918. And the Palestine front, as you can see, is on the left there. And the story of Victorian Colonel Stanley Savage follows a similar vein. As a member of the elite Dunster Force, Savage and his colleagues defended a column of some 80,000 Armenian and Assyrian refugees fleeing the invading Turkish army in northern Iran in 1918. Savage was awarded the Distinguished Service Order for his role in the rescue effort. And that, in that right arrow here, shows where quite a number of Armenian refugees had escaped and where the Dunster Force was in operation. And the Australian War Memorial has quite a large collection of photographs of the Armenian refugees who were saved by ANZAC forces. So the one on the left is from Armenian refugees who were rescued on the in Mesopotamia, northern Iran. And on the one on the right is a photograph of Armenian refugees rescued in Es Salt, Palestine in 1918. About 5,000 Armenians, many from the refugee camps in Egypt, were formed into a battalion by the French in 1916, known as the Armenian Legion. They fought alongside the Australian Light Horsemen under the command of General Edmund Allenby. The Armenian Legion took part in the decisive battles in Palestine in September 1918, which saw the defeat of the Ottoman forces. Some Armenian interpreters, like Armenak Kememian, played an important role in Allenby's victories in Palestine and Syria. Armenak was killed beside four Australians when an enemy bomb was dropped into their camp on 17 April 1917. His remains were later transferred to the Australian section of the Beersheba War Cemetery under the protection of the Commonwealth War Graves, a Graves Commission, where he lies among the ANZACs with whom he served. And that's a photo of his grave in the Beersheba War Cemetery. Now, getting onto the home front, every major newspaper in Australia covered the Armenian genocide with regularity, the Melbourne Age having published more than 40 articles in 1915 alone. News about the Armenian massacres mainly appeared in the war news columns beside reports of the ANZAC's deeds. This gave extensive coverage to the Armenians' plight. These are just some examples of newspapers' articles that were published in the Australian press at the time. The story of Armenian suffering evoked a strong humanitarian response in Australia at the time, leading to the establishment of the Armenian Relief Fund, which began in Victoria in 1915, spread throughout the country, and continued its work for over a decade. In 1917, the Victorian War Council recognised the Armenian Relief Fund as a patriotic fund, one considered as having been formed for the purpose of supporting Australia's allies as well as its own soldiers. The 22nd of April 1917 was designated as Armenia Sunday in Victoria, and churches across the state helped collect over £2,000. The ANZAC Memorial Service of Melbourne, for example, donated funds to the Armenian Relief Appeal in 1917. The plight of the Armenians also featured in the stirring speeches made during recruitment drives to increase the number of reinforcements for the ANZACs at the front. In one such recruitment drive held in Victoria in May 1917, Lieutenant Les Holder brought to the attention of the audience what had happened to the Armenians in southern Turkey, the refugees that had been at Port Said. He said, "If you love and honour your women, your own women relatives, cannot you see that they expect you as a man to go and fight for them, so that what happened to the women of our allies would not happen to them?" In Sydney, the Armenian Relief Movement mobilised a broad spectrum of the city's religious, political and civic leaders, including many leading feminists. The Lord Mayor of Sydney, James Smith, became the Armenian Relief Fund's first chairman in December 1918. Among its 30 participants were some of Sydney's most influential residents, representatives of several churches, but also leaders of the city's business and philanthropic life. The general manager of the Bank of New South Wales, now Westpac, and the general manager of the Bank of Australasia, now ANZ, became the fund's joint treasurers. Businessmen such as William Cooper of the chocolate makers Cadbury Limited and Charles Lloyd Jones, director of the department store David Jones, became executive members of the fund. Charles Lloyd Jones also was the first chairman of the Australian Broadcasting Commission. In 1922, the head office of the Armenian Relief Fund was located at the Red Cross headquarters on 34 Jamison Street, Sydney, not far from where we are tonight. Eleanor McKinnon, OBE, an executive member of the New South Wales Red Cross Committee, also a member of the National Council of Women, became the secretary of the Armenian Relief Fund of New South Wales. The fund's headquarters were later moved to 333 George Street, which included a shopfront where needlework made by Armenian orphans was sold. And in its drive to awaken public consciousness, the Armenian Relief Committees prepared a number of pamphlets containing visual and literary images of Armenian suffering and innocence. And these are just some examples there. And by December 1922, every Australian state had an Armenian Relief Committee with regional sub-branches. By early 1923, a National Armenian Relief Committee was formed based in Adelaide, which coordinated the shipping, supplies and organisation of the various state committees. And just to give you an example, the treasurer of the Armenian Relief Fund of South Australia was Brigadier General Stanley Price Weir, who was a Gallipoli veteran. So the Armenian Relief Appeal also appealed to a lot of World War I veterans who'd come back home and were aware of the plight of the Armenians. The Prime Minister of Australia, William Billy Hughes, promised that free freight to the Middle East would be provided by the Commonwealth line of steamers for goods collected by the Armenian Relief Committees. And that's a photo there of the first shipment that left Australia to the Middle East in September 1922. And a banner proudly proclaimed Australian flour for starving Armenian children. And Melbourne Anglican Archbishop Harrington Lees blessed the flour before it was shipped, and you have leaders from other denominations beside him. The Armenian relief movement culminated in the establishment of an Australian-run orphanage for some 1,700 Armenian orphans in Antelias, near Beirut, Lebanon. It was run and supported by Australians and New Zealanders. Dr. Alexander Leeper, Professor of Classics at the University of Melbourne and the President of the Victorian Friends of Armenia Committee in the 1920s, regarded it as a privilege for Australia, the youngest of nations, to have had the opportunity to save and restore the members of one of the oldest of nations. And that photo, which was taken at the orphanage in February 1922, has a number of Australians that you probably can't notice, but I'll just point them out to you. That's the Reverend James Cresswell, and below him there's a Miss Gordon from Melbourne and Miss Hilda King, who was the secretary of the Australian Students Christian Movement from Melbourne. The Armenian Relief Movement continued until the 1940s and is arguably the first such sustained humanitarian relief effort in Australia's history. Some of the humanitarian organisations which were involved in the Armenian Relief Movement, such as the Save the Children Fund, continue to exist today. Australian women were particularly concerned at the suffering of the Armenian children and of the thousands of Armenian women who had been abducted into Muslim households during the genocide. Australian women delegates to the annual League of Nations Assembly held at Geneva were vocal supporters of the League of Nations effort to rescue the abducted Armenian women and children. Women's organisations such as the National Council of Women contributed funds towards this rescue movement. So these are just some names of Australian women who attended the League of Nations Assembly as what they were called alternate delegates. They didn't have voting rights at that stage. And all of these who were named spoke out about the Armenian relief movement. And Eleanor McKinnon in particular devoted her entire speech at the League of Nations to the cause of Armenian relief. And that's just a photo of the League of Nations commissioned, had a commissioner, her name was Karen Yeppe, she was a Danish missionary, whose task was to rescue and rehabilitate as many abducted Armenian women and children from the French mandate of Syria. And she estimated that there were some 30,000 Armenian women and children who were had been abducted during the Armenian genocide and were living in Syria at that time in Muslim households. And with her efforts, she was able to rescue about 2,000 Armenian women and children between 1920 and 1926. And what was very common was when Armenian women had been abducted, the abductors would tattoo their faces to brand them as Muslim women, and they were kind of like branded like cattle. And the reasons why they did that was that they would be too embarrassed to run away and go back to their community. And secondly, if they did run away, it would be easy to determine who they belonged to. But they still managed to rescue quite a number of women, and we've got plenty of photos like that of Armenian rescued women and children. And just to conclude, it is quite common nowadays to find elderly Australians who can still remember as children being told by their parents that if they don't finish the food on their plates, to remember the starving Armenians. Sadly, the story of Armenia, Australia and the Great War is largely excluded from our nation's historiography of World War I. Perhaps an explanation can be found in a passage from a work by Paul Shackle on the relationship between power and collective memory, in which he suggests that public memory is more a reflection of present political and social relations than a true reconstruction of the past. As we mark the 101st anniversary of both the Armenian Genocide and the Gallipoli campaign, perhaps it's time that the link between these two events takes its rightful place in our nation's collective memory of World War I. Thank you.
Many thanks. Now, Janet Grundy's got some copies of Armenia, Australia and the Great War by our author and Peter Stanley outside, and I'm sure Vikan would be happy to sign copies after the event. And so we come to questions and discussion, and we've got to the top of the hour or no later than, so we've got plenty of time. Just reflect for a minute on the what might have been. I mean, as you know, the landing in the Dardanelles, the aim was to take Constantinople and therefore to attack the German forces from behind in order to take the pressure off the Allies on the Western Front. Now, that would have led, of course, to the immediate fall of the Ottoman Empire. What kind of implication would that have been for the Armenians? And by then, I mean, let's say the invasion had succeeded by, say, May 1915, June 1915, if that had come about, what would then have been the prospects for the Armenians? I mean, would it have been that grim? Were most of them dead by then, or had they been driven out by then, or would it have been a different outcome?
Had the Allies taken Constantinople so quickly, say by May 1915, the outcome would not have been the same. There was no way that they would be able to kill that number of people within such a short time. But because it was delayed, and I'd say it took the authorities probably about 5 or 6 months to be able to kill at least 1 million people, because a lot of them were deported and so on. So had the Allies won Gallipoli quite speedily, I'd say that there would have still been massacres and deportations, but not to the same degree as what took place.
Down, Anne, and then Richard. Yep.
The argument from the Turkish side is that it didn't happen, it isn't a genocide because there are no documents that the government ordered it. I'd like to know whether that was a deliberate ploy on their part in the beginning, because obviously someone gave the orders, or whether they destroyed the documents. So why is there no documents?
Okay. There are documents. There are deportation orders. So they don't hide the fact that they deported Armenians from all over the empire. They're just arguing that there was no intention to kill them. Okay? But there were concurrent orders. So those orders were emanating from the government, so legitimate, you can actually see them, saying Armenians must be deported. But the secret orders were emanating from the Committee of Union and Progress, which is kind of the political party that was ruling the government. Those documents don't exist, and they're the ones, documents that were ordering to kill the Armenians. But there were trials held in Constantinople after the war, where those documents were seen, but the trial records have all been lost. But what we know from the trials is from the official gazette of the Ottoman government that these trials existed. Had those trial papers still existed, then we would have documentation of the Armenian genocide.
You think they're lost, not destroyed?
We don't know. Yeah. We don't know. That can't be found.
Could you talk about the huge difference between the way the Germans have responded after the Second World War and the way the Turkish government to this day maintains the position it does? Yeah. It's such a marked difference between the two attitudes.
Yeah.
There's got to be a lot behind what that difference is all about.
We kind of do explain it in our book. There's a difference. See, when Germany lost World War II, the Allies took over its government. It had lost the war, and you had the Nuremberg trials. With the Ottoman Empire, although the Ottoman Empire lost the war, and there was a Treaty of Sevres that was signed, that treaty was never ratified, and Kemal Atatürk came up, and he said, well, we're not going to recognize that treaty, and he created this Turkish nationalist government, and they signed a new treaty called the Treaty of Lausanne, which called for an amnesty for all those... the declaration of amnesty for all crimes committed between 1914 and 1922. But there can only be an amnesty if there was a crime committed in the first place. So even though the Ottoman Empire lost the war, Turkey won it. So there's a difference there. Had Turkey lost World War I and the Allies taken over the Ottoman government, we had these international trials, which the Sevres Treaty had stipulated for an international tribunal for those criminals. Had that taken place, I think it would be much different today.
After the war, is there any record of Mustafa Atatürk's attitude towards the Armenians?
Is there any evidence of Atatürk's attitude towards the Armenians after 1918?
Yeah, so basically, with Atatürk's new government, there's an ideological continuity from the Young Turk government of World War I and Atatürk's government, because a lot of those criminals, in 1919, 1920, a lot of Turkish criminals were taken to Malta, who were going to be put on trial once the Sevres Treaty was ratified. But a lot of those criminals who were involved in the Armenian genocide of World War I received important posts in Atatürk's government. And one of them is Şükrü Kaya, who was head of the deportation, overseeing the deportations during World War I. He became the interior ministry in the Atatürk government, and he's responsible for the crimes that were committed against the Kurds in the 1930s in Turkey, in southeastern Turkey. So you see an ideological continuity. Even though Kemal Atatürk himself was not involved with the Armenian genocide in World War I, but his government continued the policies and recruited those who had been involved during World War I.
There's a question here.
Turkey, obviously, or the Ottoman Empire, obviously had a lot of minorities, of which this was one. Were any other minorities treated in the same way? And is there any particular discriminant that it just differentiates those that were mistreated from those that weren't?
So the question is, what about other minorities in the Ottoman Empire? Was it just the Armenians who were discriminated against, or were others as well?
Yeah, so you had Kurds, Circassians, who were Muslims. So during World War I, they used Islamic solidarity in some ways to commit these atrocities against the Armenians. And you had other Christian minorities, such as Greeks and Assyrians. So the Assyrians and the Greeks also suffered during World War I and its aftermath. But with the 1915 World War I deportations and the deportation order that the Ottoman government had released on the 27th of May, it specifically mentions the Armenians to be deported. But the Assyrians, who were under the Armenian millet, so there was a kind of system in the Ottoman Empire, because their numbers were not as high as the Armenians, and they were not an Orthodox, their religion was similar to the Armenian religion. They suffered along with the Armenians as well, but not many people know about the Assyrian plight.
Before we go to the next question, tell us about the Armenian religion, because there is also a Christian Armenian group, isn't there, as well as the there's a Catholic Armenian group as well as the Orthodox Armenian group.
The majority of Armenians are what's called Armenian Apostolic, which is it's a national church, similar to the Church of England being a national church. But you have another 5 or 10% of the Armenians are Protestant or Catholic. And they're a result largely of Catholic and Protestant missionaries who entered the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century. But the majority are Armenian Apostolic.
There's a question here.
I was just wondering, what was the impetus then of doing this genocide during 1915? Like, what they thought they could get away with it during World War
I? Yeah. So the question is, what was the impetus in 1915?
Yeah.
Okay, so the Armenians were one of the few minorities left who hadn't gained independence while the Ottoman Empire was disintegrating in the 19th century.
Right.
So the Balkans, you had the Greeks and the Serbians. And in 1914, the Ottoman Empire had signed a reform agreement with Russia, where and two independent administrators were going to go from European countries to oversee these reforms. And the Turks, or the Ottoman Empire, saw this as a kind of step to autonomy. And so when they joined World War I, it was a cover for them to actually eliminate the Armenians so that there's no chance for them to gain some kind of autonomy or independence like the Balkan states did in the 19th century. So it was like an opportunity for them.
Why wasn't the Service Brigade...
Now, hang on just a minute. Let's... Gabrielle, I can't see who it was yet. Gabrielle?
Pattern recognition is something that we have as we get older. And I'm noticing the depressing similarity between that particular genocide and the genocide that's going on today. Completely consistent.
Mm.
The destruction of minorities who are not Muslim,
yeah.
The ravishing and taking of sex slaves,
mm-hmm.
The murder of the men,
yeah.
The abuse of the children. Can you say something about that? That there's this dreadful continuity that
definitely is
occurring.
Yeah.
Okay, so the suggestion there's a continuity between
yeah.
The crimes of 1915 and what's happening today in relation to minorities, taking of sex slaves,
yeah.
Women as sex slaves, etc.
Particularly in, obviously, what ISIS is doing now is very similar to what happened in World War I. And I was helping a lady write a chapter on the comparisons between the two, and the comparisons are striking.
Would that be because that's Muhammad's example when he was warring in Arabia and
yeah.
Pushing out the Jews and other minorities?
The Young Turks used Islam as a tool, so they declared a jihad in November 1914. But the Young Turks themselves were quite secular. When I say secular, they weren't. They had more of a racist ideology than they did religious, but they did use religion to incite the masses to commit the crimes. So there are a lot of similarities between what's happening now and what happened during World War I, using religion.
Okay, so there was someone around the corner, but if you speak up, I'll translate it. Just got to be quick.
Why wasn't the first treaty ratified? The Service Treaty.
Yeah, because of the.
So you just repeat the question.
Why was the Treaty of Sevres not ratified?
Right.
And the main reason is because of Kemal Ataturk's rise to power, and also the fact that the Soviet Union, no one really wanted to border the Soviet Union as well. And the French made a deal with so you had, in 1921, you had two governments in the Ottoman Empire. You had one at Istanbul that was pro-Allied, that had signed the Sevres Treaty. Then you had this other government that was in Ankara, which was led by Kemal Ataturk, and he refused to acknowledge the Sevres Treaty, but he was more powerful than the Istanbul or Constantinople government. And the British and the French eventually yielded, and they thought, we don't want another war, and they signed a Treaty of Lausanne with Kemal Ataturk. And that happened after the Smyrna catastrophe. I'm not sure if you're aware, in September 1922, the Greeks were fighting a war with the Turkish nationalists, and the Kemal Ataturk took Smyrna, and he headed towards the Gallipoli, and that's where the British forces were. And so they signed the armistice called the Mudanya Armistice, and that led to the Lausanne Treaty. But we do talk about that in our book.
Here.
The Armenian question, if I can call it that, predated April 1915.
It did, yeah.
You spoke about the arrest of people in April, Armenians in April. And as I understand it, when the bombardment started in the Dardanelles,
mm-hmm.
there were plans for the government to vacate Istanbul, formerly Constantinople, was that the catalyst? Did they receive them as a fifth column? Was that part? What was the catalyst for those this event?
Yeah. So basically, up until April 24, they were obviously the Ottomans were not sure if the Allies were going to attack Constantinople. But when the landings happened, that was kind of like a trigger. Mm. They realized this is real. There's a chance that we can lose, the capital. We may lose the war very quickly. So that was kind of a catalyst to start the process. So they deported, 200 Armenian intellectuals from Constantinople. And then that was a blueprint for arrests all around the Ottoman Empire. But I have to also mention that at the same time, there was in the east of the Ottoman Empire, in a place called Van, the Armenians had kind of, there was an uprising of Armenians at that time as well. So you had, and also in Egypt, you had some losses there by the Ottomans. So there was a lot of factors that radicalized the Ottoman government to take on.
Right, there's a question there.
Based on your studies and your understanding of Turkish politics at the time, what parallels could you draw between the Ottomans at the time and today's government led by Erdogan?
Oh, yeah. I'd say there are quite a number of parallels, because even, as I said, a year before the Armenian genocide began, there were reforms and things looked good, bright. Then all of a sudden it turned. And when Erdogan first came to power, actually things started to improve for minorities. It wasn't illegal to say Armenian genocide anymore. And all of a sudden now it's gone to worse than what it was back then. So this pattern has happened in the Ottoman Empire for centuries. It happened in the 19th century as well, before Sultan Abdul Hamid came to power in 1876. When he first came to power, there was a constitution, but a year later he abolished the constitution, and things went from bad to worse.
Right, so... right down the back, yep.
Do you have a view why Israel exactly countered the Armenian genocide?
The question is, well, the suggestion is that Israel has not recognized the Armenian genocide.
Yeah. It's the same reason why Australia hasn't, and why the United States hasn't, and why Britain hasn't. Because Turkey plays an important part in the international community. It's a part of the G20. It's a NATO ally. It's a key economic partner of the West. Companies from all these countries are competing against each other for infrastructure projects in Turkey. There are oil pipelines that are going to be coming from Central Asia. So you've got, on the one hand, a moral issue of recognizing a historical truth and an injustice. And on the other hand, you've got practical considerations, which usually features in foreign policy. And so in Israel, in Australia, we seem to forget about the moral side of this issue and concentrate on, economic self-interest as guiding our policy. And that's basically the reason, what I think.
Tell us about the immigration of Armenians, mainly, I think, after the Second World War. But they were obviously, over the period, welcomed by various Australian governments as an immigrant group.
Yeah, in the 1960s it began. 1962, they opened the door for Armenian immigration from Egypt, and then later from Lebanon and parts of the Middle East. But before the 1960s, it was very difficult for Armenians to migrate to Australia.
But they came before the Turks came in large numbers. They came in the late 60s.
They did, yeah, because in 1962, they had a special program to allow those in Egypt, particularly Armenians, Greeks, and Italians, to migrate to Australia without requiring sponsorship. So it was a kind of pilot program. And that's why they came then. But before then, you had Armenian migration from British colonies in Southeast Asia, like Singapore, Indonesia, and India. So yeah, the White Australia policy applied to the Armenians before the 1960s.
So what you're saying, therefore, is the White Australian policy was lifted before the announcement, which was actually in 1966. Mm-hmm. So you're saying that before the Harold Holt government announced the policy into the White Australia policy, we were taking people in who would have been banned under strict enforcement of the White Australia policy.
Yes.
There's a question right down the back.
I noticed that most of the relief efforts on the home fronts here in Australia were based in Victoria, with a few based in Sydney. Mm-hmm. Is that because Melbourne was back then the capital of Australia and Sydney was the largest city, I would say? And if so, were there efforts in other states? Because we don't really hear about what happens in the other states very much. We just hear about what happens in New South Wales.
So the suggestion is that most of the relief efforts were based in Melbourne, which until 1927 was the national capital.
Yeah.
Is that the reason? There was some in Sydney, and what about the other places?
Look, from what my research, what I think is that you had a woman named Edith Searle who had started an Armenian Relief Fund in 1909. She was in Tasmania back then. And she moved to Melbourne. So when World War I began, she started that fund again. So that was and she was in Melbourne. And you also had a very active Armenian fellow named Harutyun Balakian, who was in Melbourne. And so for some reason, that's where the relief effort began. But in 1916, you did have a committee, an Armenian Relief Committee in Sydney. And in 1917, there was one in Adelaide. So the movement kind of did spread, but it did begin from Melbourne. And I can't tell you if the reason is because that was the capital or not, but it's more because of that woman who had started the relief fund in 1909 happened to be in Melbourne during World War One.
Can I ask a bit more about Thomas White?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm interested in him being in the Lyons government and later Menzies. But
yeah.
How much did he get involved and how much was it because of his experience in Gallipoli?
There's a question about Thomas White, who was, as you said, on Gallipoli, later became a minister in the Menzies government.
The Lyons
government and the Menzies government, the first Menzies government.
Yeah.
So White.
So Thomas White was on the part of the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force, and he was a pilot, and he was captured. And out of all the memoirs I've read on Australian prisoners of war, he gives the most details of the Armenian massacres. He seemed to have been really interested in the issue. And I've looked through his papers at the National Library of Australia archives, and he's got a whole folder based on this issue. And there's even transcripts of the speeches that he used to give, which he used to read about Talat Pasha giving orders to exterminate the Armenians. So he was actually, and we also found receipts that he had donated to the Armenian Relief Funds, and a lot of the pamphlets that I showed you earlier are included in that folder. So the fact that he was a prisoner of war and he had experienced and witnessed what had occurred, he retained that interest when he came back to Australia.
So where were the Australian POWs based in the Ottoman Empire? Were they spread around or were they in one particular place?
They were spread around, but the two main internment camps were at Afyon Karahisar, which I showed you earlier, which I'll go back to it.
Yes.
Okay, here we go. So the Afyon Karahisar internment camp, and it wasn't just the church, it was also the Armenian quarter. And what's really interesting about Afyon Karahisar, it's deep in the interior of what is today Turkey, very far from the war zones, but yet the Armenians were deported from Afyon Karahisar and in Ankara. So it just goes to show that deportations weren't just on the war zone or because of military necessity.
How would someone who's in a prison of war camp know what was going on outside the camp?
Okay, because he came from Mesopotamia, so they walked from Mesopotamia there, and so he witnessed Armenian deportees along the way, and he also heard and they spoke to German officers, and so they were able to learn. And also before they went to the church, he mentions how Armenian women and children were taken out of the church before they came in. So all the Australian prisoners of war memoirs that I have read, they all mention the Armenian massacres, some with more detail than others.
So did the Turks think the Armenians were going to collaborate with the Allies because the Armenians were Christian or what? Why did they sort of think they had to leave, sort of take them away from them?
Well, it's funny because a lot of Armenians in the Ottoman army that fought loyally with the Ottomans.
Right.
But I think the main threat, and when you look more deeply into it, it's because of the reform agreement. They thought it was a cover of war. If we get rid of the Armenians, then we get rid of the Armenian question. It's as simple as that. And in the end, it kind of paid off because Turkey's created this homogenous nation state now with no Armenians, no Greeks, and no Assyrians.
Do we know...
The attention that Amal Clooney managed to bring to this cause recently, was it in the Court of The Hague? I can't remember which court was it?
European Court of Human Rights.
European Court of Human Rights,
Has that had any impact on worldview? I mean, we've had talks on the Armenian Genocide before, maybe 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And I've been under attack from the Turkish consul for writing something they didn't like. Has anything changed? Because you're coming to speak tonight. We haven't had any problems from them. Mal Clooney's out there, and the superstars are behind it.
Yeah.
Has there been any shift? It may be that it'll take a long time before recognition, but is the world shifting on this at all?
I think the world knows what happened. I don't think the only people who deny it are usually those Turkish nationalist historians. I think the world knows the truth, but there is a legal issue here because the word genocide, or back then, it wasn't a crime to kill your own people. So the Genocide Convention, actually the first case that was tried under the Genocide Convention was 1998, the Rwandan case. So even the Holocaust, wasn't tried under the United Nations Genocide Convention. So for the army, it's very difficult, and the perpetrators are now all dead. And there's no legal system that tries a country for a crime committed, 100 years ago. So there are some legal issues there. But I think overwhelming public opinion is that they all know, the whole world knows what happened, just like Charles Bean said.
We're coming to the end. Can I just ask you, do we know what the British and the French and New Zealand, or the New Zealand's probably would have been with the Australians, but what the British soldiers and the French soldiers saw? Or did they see the same thing?
Yeah, plenty. I've got a whole collection of British memoirs. And there's a guy in New Zealand who's researching all the repatriation reports by New Zealand prisoners, ex-prisoners of war. And as I said to you, every memoir that I've read, every repatriation report makes mention of this. And so you can piece together the puzzle from... And it corroborates the American and German eyewitness accounts.
So just before I ask the final question, I should say thanks to Sassoon Gregorian who told us about this forthcoming book when it was forthcoming. Now the book's out... It's quite an honour to be in a book with Peter Stanley, who would be one of our most respected and well-regarded historians. So how did that work out? What did you do? What did Peter Stanley do? And how come you came together on this project?
That's interesting. He was Peter Stanley was leading a battlefront tour in France in 2011. And I saw him on Late Line ABC, and I thought this guy would be interested in my work. So I sent him an email, and he sent me an email back a few hours later. And we met, when he came back, we met in Canberra. And I spoke to him about my research. And then he came to my house and had a look at what I had collected, my book collection, and even what I had done years before, is I found the names of Australian relief workers, the ones that were in that photo. And I approached the genealogical society to find the descendants of those relief workers. And I sent letters out. And to my surprise, I received documents, I received photographs. And a day before Christmas in 2013, I received a 200-page diary by the Reverend Cresswell, who had visited all those refugee camps, the original diary. And so I had this enormous collection of... And the thing with humanitarian history, unlike military history, you can go to the archives of the Australian War Memorial, it's all catalogued. There's no central archive for humanitarian history. So you've got to find little bits and pieces here and there from archives and so on. So it takes years of painstaking research to reconstruct what happened. And prior to this, about 10 years ago, I began writing peer-reviewed articles for journals. And... For example, the Historical Society of South Australia published an article of mine, the Victorian Historical Journal, and my latest article was published by the Royal Australian Historical Society of Australia in their peer-reviewed journal, which I found it to be a great honour, on Australian women and the Armenian Relief Movement. So I'd gone through that process before I had met Peter Stanley, and he'd seen that, I'm not an institutional academic, but I'm someone who's passionate, who's been collecting, who's been researching, And, you know, we wrote this book together. I mean, I wrote probably 70% of it, but he helped shape it. He wrote the prologue, the epilogue. He edited bits in here and there and added context because he's got, you know, vast knowledge of Australian military and social history. So this book, it's more about Australian social and cultural history than it is about the Armenian genocide. So that's one thing that you'll probably take out of this book is we've got a few chapters, obviously, we've got to provide the context. But yeah, so hopefully you can get something out of it. Thank you.
Many thanks to Vidkun Babkenian for a most informative discussion about not only the important issue of the Armenian genocide, but also how Australia, which was a long way away from the Ottoman Empire, reacted to this, and individual Australians were thoughtful and also generous, and some of them have been named tonight, and there are more of them mentioned in the book. So, as I said, Janet Grundy's got copies of Armenia, Australia and the Great War Outside, and congratulations on your work, well done, and hope you do some more. Thank you. Thank you, folks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.